This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We knew it might happen, but most of us were still shocked when America went to war 1 year ago today. Desperate for information, we couldn't budge from our radios and TVs. That first night, three reporters from CNN broadcast live from their hotel room in Baghdad over the deafening sounds of the most powerful air bombardment in history. The combination of guts and technology established CNN as the place most likely to be there live where the action is. On January 20th, Iraq expelled virtually the whole Foreign Press Corps, with the exception of CNN. Some people believed it was unethical for CNN to broadcast from behind enemy lines. But around the world, even heads of state were reputed to be getting some of their up-to-the-minute information from CNN. My guest Robert Weiner was CNN's executive producer in Baghdad from the time of Iraq's invasion of Kuwait through the first week of the war. He's written a new book called Live from Baghdad. I asked him to describe the moment he realized the bombing had begun.
Well, I was in the workspace of the Al Rashid, our office in room 906 with Bernie Shaw, when a flash of red light exploded in the sky. For the first moment, I didn't really want to believe it was happening, but I knew it actually was. And suddenly the sky was just filled with enormous amounts of light and sound. Bernie lunged for the four wire, that was our open telephone line to Atlanta, and we began broadcasting to our audience for the next 17 hours, uncensored. It was a hellacious moment, absolutely terrifying. People were running down the corridors of the Al Rashid, many people going to the shelter. I myself was frightened to death. For a while I went down to the shelter to check on my colleagues, then came back up to room 906 of the Al Rashid, watched Bernie, John, and Peter continue to report. After a while, I sort of felt superfluous, and I returned to the shelter. At that point, the Iraqis locked us in the shelter, and we had to stay there until about 6 in the morning. But John, Peter, and Bernie managed to continue reporting from 906, and I guess the world knows what happened next.
What was the struggle going on in your mind between trying to save your life and trying to keep the story on the air? Trying to be up on the ninth floor or trying to be down in the shelter?
Well, the real struggle actually began several hours before the war broke out, shortly after Marlon Fitzwater had urged reporters to leave Baghdad immediately. And most of those reporters that were in the Iraqi capital did so. In some cases ordered out by their news organization. CNN left the decision up to us on the ground, and there were eight CNN staffers in Baghdad, and Bernie Shaw had come over, of course, to interview Saddam Hussein and had stayed until the 16th. He was planning to stay until the 17th on the promise that an interview might take place then. Once we were told that President Saddam would not be doing the interview with Bernie, he was prepared to leave on the morning of the 17th, and we held this meeting, and three other staffers opted to leave along with Bernie. Volunteering to remain behind were Peter Arnett, of course, John Holloman, myself, and an extremely courageous engineer named Nick Robertson.
Why did you want to stay behind?
For a couple of reasons. Number one, I had been in Baghdad since August. I was the executive producer. People were in Baghdad at my behest, and I felt that it would be unconscionable for me to ask people to come to Baghdad to risk their lives and then for me to leave. So even though I was terribly frightened, I felt I should remain. Another key reason was my sense of competition. I felt that if I left, many other people might follow my lead, and our coverage would be compromised, and I wanted our coverage to be the best.
One of the many coups that you were responsible for was getting this open telephone line between CNN in Baghdad and CNN headquarters in Atlanta, and you got this installed in time for the beginning of the war. What did it take to get the Iraqi cooperation in installing this?
Well, actually, the man that really deserves credit for putting in that four wire, as I explained in my book, is a fellow named Eason Jordan, who was a vice president for international coverage. Basically, he, in conjunction with our satellite folks in Atlanta, pushed the Iraqis to put in a line between Baghdad and Amman. And as far as the Iraqis knew, that was the only line that existed, from Baghdad to Amman. But then we continued the line from Amman to Atlanta. Now, once it was established and the Iraqis heard us using the four wire, which we did for a couple of months prior to the outbreak of the war, they came to me and said, Mr. Robert, you've tricked us. This line goes to Atlanta. But we had a pretty good relationship with these folks, and I said, well, it's going to Atlanta. Why not? Why not keep it up? Otherwise, we'll have to do things delayed on tape, and since we're already in Amman, let's let it go to Atlanta. And they basically relented.
Some of your colleagues at other networks said that CNN got special treatment because CNN had been less critical of its coverage of Iraq.
Well, yeah, I know they've said that. I think our executive vice president, Ed Turner, you know, put it best that 1991 was a vintage year for sour grapes.
One of the keys to CNN's coverage from Baghdad was the technology you were able to bring in. And you had gotten Saddam Hussein's permission to bring in a portable TV transmitter. But what had happened was that there weren't any left at CNN because CNN thought it had already been turned down permission. Would you describe what happened there and how you managed eventually to get in the portable transmitter?
Sure. You're absolutely right. We had lobbied. I had lobbied for months to bring in a television station, our uplink, our transmitter. The Iraqis had always said no, and finally they relented. And I called my boss, Eason Jordan, and said, okay, that's it. We've got permission. Let's bring one in. And he said, we don't have one. So I said, well, I guess we'll just have to bite the bullet and buy one. And he said, good grief, you know, that's about $400,000. But he went to Tom Johnson and Ed Turner, and within an hour he came back on the line and said that the network was going ahead to buy one. How we were able to get one in was based on a negotiating strategy I had with the Iraqis, which worked as follows. We did not have permission to have an Inmarsat telephone in there in the first place.
That's a satellite telephone.
Right. So I went to the Iraqis just prior to the outbreak of the war, and I said, look, guys, it's pretty obvious that the telephone system here is not going to exist once the war begins. And they said, well, we're not so sure. In fact, the Minister of Information, JASM, had said to me, Mr. Robert, and he said this very seriously, American planes will never reach Baghdad. Whether this was posturing or whatever, he did relate that. And I said, well, Mr. Minister, trust me, if American planes come here, the telecommunications center will be a prime target. So let's see if we could work out a compromise. We will continue to use our four wire, which goes through your telecommunications center. But in the event the telephone service no longer works, I then want permission to use my Inmarsat satellite telephone. You see, the Iraqis were very paranoid about the satellite telephone. They had actually never seen one before, and their security services were very reluctant to bring it in. But I basically said we won't use it, and I gave them my word of honor that we wouldn't use it until or unless the telephone tower was gone. And finally they said yes. So then I went back to the Iraqis the following day and said, look, guys, we also know, and let's assume that Iraqi television is going to be bombed. How about working out the same deal, letting us bring in our own television transmitter, but I give you my word of honor, we will not use it so long as Iraqi TV is capable of satelliting our material. And they agreed.
After the bombing started, the Iraqis suggested that you leave the Al-Rashid Hotel, and they said they would take you to an undisclosed location where they thought you would be safer. You refused. Why?
I did not like the idea of being cut off from the relative safety of the Al-Rashid, even though a cruise missile had landed in the on the grounds just before. I didn't like the idea of being cut off from our drivers. I didn't like the idea of being out in the countryside, perhaps for weeks, and the agony that would cause my wife and children and certainly my parents. I must say that Peter was single-minded in his determination to cover the story at all costs and was willing to go out to wherever the Iraqis wanted to take him, so long as he could stay and report the story. But Nick Robertson and I, that's our engineer, decided that we wanted to follow our instincts, and our instincts were telling us this wasn't a particularly good idea. I felt badly leaving Peter, I must say, for a while, but the cruise missile that came in and propelled me across the room shook me up terribly. My hands were shaking so badly. I was just absolutely frightened. And so I decided it was time to leave. We taught Peter how to use the Inmarsat satellite telephone. Nick gave him a quick course. And Nick and I departed. When I got to Amman, I figured, okay, I'll take a breather in Amman and then return to Baghdad. Nick did, and others did. But when I got to Amman, I was told that my father had suffered a severe heart attack when the war broke out. No one had told me this when I was in Baghdad. And so I flew to Florida to take care of him.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Robert Wiener, who is the executive producer for CNN in Baghdad from August of 1990 till the first few days after the war. There was apparently a code to let reporters know that the bombing was about to begin. The mm-hmm. code was, everyone's fine at home, but the kids have the sniffles. But you didn't know about this. How did you, who were heading up the CNN operation, manage to not be informed? How were you left out?
Well, that code was related by the Pentagon to news organizations in Washington. For some reason, CNN was never told about the code. I asked Ed Turner after the war, did you ever hear of this code? And he said, absolutely not. I only heard about it when CBS came running into our workspace saying, we just got the code, and ABC just got the code. We didn't get any code.
So how do you feel about that?
Well, once we knew everyone else had the code, it really didn't, it was such a ridiculous code. I'm not so sure everyone's got the sniffles. It really didn't make a difference. Everyone was leaving, and ultimately we stayed. So code or no code, we stayed to do our job.
One last question. It was CNN that got out the tape of the downed American pilots being interrogated
right.
by Iraqis.
I was there then.
Yeah, and you I think, got it out. This was originally broadcast on Iraqi television.
Mm-hmm.
You got a copy of the tape to
mm-hmm.
show on CNN, and that's how we all first saw it. Did you ever ask yourself if the Iraqis did this in the first place, thinking that perhaps it would end up on CNN and that would be a good thing for them?
Well, I think that the Iraqis had no doubt that it would end up on CNN and other networks, which it did. Whether it would be a good thing, I think the Iraqis thought that seeing American pilots in Baghdad would show the world that the coalition was vulnerable.
So did you have any doubts about putting that on TV?
No, none at all. I had a lot of personal feelings because I'm an American citizen and I saw these pilots. They were terribly frightened. You could see in their eyes they
yeah.
didn't know whether they would be paraded through the streets of Baghdad, whether they would be physically abused or tortured. My heart really went out to them. By the same token, I felt that this is news and our audience should see and hear from these guys. You know, we're in the business of putting out information. We don't believe that you can have too much information. We put it out there, and we have a lot of respect for our audience, and that's that.
Robert Wiener, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Surely, thank you.
Robert Wiener was CNN's executive producer in Baghdad. His new book is Live from Baghdad. Coming up, we look at the pro-democracy movement in Kuwait. This is Fresh Air. After the liberation of Kuwait, many Kuwaitis involved in the country's pro-democracy movement hoped the global spotlight would call attention to their cause and that the United States would help pressure the emir to reinstate the Constitution, which was suspended in 1986, allow free elections immediately, give women the right to vote, and end press restrictions. Elections are scheduled for October of this year, and press restrictions have officially been lifted, but the cabinet still has the power to shut down opposition media. Abdullah al-Nabari is the leader of the Kuwaiti Democratic Forum, the only declared opposition political party in the country. He's an economist who remained in his country throughout the Iraqi occupation. He says day-to-day life in Kuwait is gradually returning to normal.
People go to their work and they lead a normal life, Of course, the population structure has been changed since there are less expatriates in Kuwait now than before. And we don't think there is enough respect for human rights. We would like that to be corrected since it is wrong in principle and harming Kuwaiti image outside.
Do you think Kuwait is any more or less democratic today than it was before the war?
Well, it wasn't democratic before the war, to start with, and it is more undemocratic today. And we thought after having such a terrible experience, everybody will learn a lesson, especially when the Kuwaiti people have proved themselves resisting the occupation, meaning that the emir would reinstate the constitution immediately. But that didn't happen. And there's no parliament, no representative government.
What kinds of people do you feel are supporting the pro-democracy movement now that you thought would have never supported it before?
It cuts across all the social spectrum, from merchants to labor, students, middle class. You have secular democratic movement, Islamic tendency, merchant groups, independents. All the active sectors of Kuwaiti population are involved in this pro-democracy movement.
Do you think it's possible that elections might bring an Islamic majority into control in the parliament? And I wonder if that's a worry of yours.
No, it is not a worry. And the Islamic groups in Kuwait are much different than the image you get from Algeria or Sudan or even Jordan. All the Islamic groups here are agreed on constitutional democracy. So the image of the Kuwaiti Islamic groups is they are much, very much different from the traditional image propagated in the West.
Let me ask you, are there any risks involved for you being a leader of the pro-democracy movement?
Well, I am not the leader of the pro-democracy movement. I am only one leading figure in one group, which is the Democratic Forum. But, there are risks, yes. Minor risks. We don't think we face risks as probably that happened, such as in Chile or in Iraq or in Syria. We've been arrested before. That could have could happen again. Thing like this, but we don't think there's more serious than that.
One last question. Today is the one-year anniversary of the start of the United States bombing of Iraq. Are you doing anything today to remember that day? Is that a day of special significance for you?
No, there's some press coverage. Of course, it means a lot to us because that was the start of our liberation. But we use the term that the country is liberated, but the people are not liberated yet.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Not at all. Bye-bye.
Abdullah Al-Nabari is the leader of the Kuwaiti Democratic Forum. He spoke to us from his home in Kuwait. Aziz Abu Hamad monitors the pro-democracy movement, the women's rights movement, and other human rights in Kuwait. He's the senior researcher of the human rights group Middle East Watch. He's made several trips to Kuwait since its liberation. I asked him if Kuwait's pro-democracy movement stands for the rights of minorities in Kuwait.
In general, they have been sidestepping these issues for historical reasons and also with an eye to the elections. As you know, under law in Kuwait, second-class citizens do not have the right to vote.
Who is that? Who is a second-class citizen?
First-class citizens are people who have settled or their ancestors settled in Kuwait since 1920. These are first-class. The second category are people who who settled in Kuwait before 1945. Those are second-class citizens, and they don't have the right to vote. And then you have Bedouins. These are about one-third of the native population, and these people don't have citizenship of either class. And, of course, they don't have the right to vote.
In what ways do you think that Kuwait is and is not closer to democracy now than it was before the start of the war.
You mean before the Iraqi invasion?
Yeah.
It's probably, in most respects, it's less close to democracy for one reason, as you probably know. The opposition, the pro-democracy movement itself, is now less vocal than it had been before the Iraqi invasion. They have to guard against espousing human rights for minorities, for example, because they fear they will be accused of Iraqi sympathies. They are afraid to champion the rights of the Bedouins because also they are afraid of being accused of supporting the enemy.
So
there is an atmosphere of fear and incrimination between the government and the opposition.
Is there anything that's particularly been on your mind today on this first anniversary of the start of the war in the Gulf?
It's just many of the hopes that we had of restoring democracy to Kuwait soon after the liberation were dashed. As I was actually in a meeting in October of 1990 under Iraqi occupation, this meeting was held in Saudi Arabia between the government and the opposition. The Crown Prince and the Prince himself, the Emir Sheikh Jaber, promised that democracy would be restored to Kuwait soon after liberation. They promised lifting of censorship. They promised that women will be recognized as full members of society. They promised many things, and now it has been almost a year since liberation, and most of these promises are yet to be fulfilled.
Why do you think the al-Sabah family has not been fulfilling its promise?
I really don't know. My guess is that they feel that they are in a weak position now after the war, since they are blamed for the invasion to start with, and they feel any opening of Kuwaiti society may actually endanger their centuries-old hold over the government.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Aziz Abu Hamad is Senior Researcher for Middle East Watch. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.